The National Sunday Law, The Argument of A.T. Jones Before the U.S. Senate Committee, December 1888, Part 6. Senator Blair, then if they had a law like this, they were wrongly convicted under the law, just as innocent men are sometimes hung. But you cannot reason that there should be no law against murder because innocent men are sometimes executed. It is fault in the administration of the law. You cannot reason from that that there should be no law. Mr. Jones, if there had been arrests of other people for working on Sunday, and anything like the numbers that there were of Seventh-day observers, and the law had been enforced upon all alike, then the iniquity would not have been so apparent. Or if those who were not Seventh-day observers and who were arrested had been convicted, even then the case would not have been so clearly one of persecution. But when in all the record of the whole 2 years' existence of the law in this form, there was not a solitary saloon keeper arrested, there was not a person who did not observe the seventh day arrested, with the exceptions named, then there could be no clearer demonstration that the law was used only as a means to vent religious spite against a class of citizens guiltless of any crime, but only of professing a religion different from that of the majority. The fact of the matter is this, and the whole history of these proceedings proves it, that from beginning to end, these prosecutions were only the manifestation of that persecuting, intolerant spirit that will always make itself felt when any class of religionists can control the civil power. The information upon which the indictments were found was treacherously given, and in the very spirit of the Inquisition. The indictment itself is a travesty of legal form and a libel upon justice. The principle was more worthy of the Dark Ages than of any civilized nation or modern time, and the Supreme Court decision that confirmed the convictions is one which is contrary to the first principles of constitutional law or constitutional compacts. And if Congress should lend its sanction to religious legislation to the extent of passing this National Sunday Bill now under consideration, and its principles should be made of force in all the states, the history of Arkansas from 1885 to 1886 would be repeated through the whole extent of the nation. This I can prove, at least so far as the attention goes, of those who are actively in favor of it. Reverend D. McAllister is one of the principal men of the National Reform Association. That association and the Women's Christian Temperance Union held a joint convention at Lakeside, Ohio in July 1887, and speaking on the subject of a national Sunday law, Dr. McAllister said, quote, "Let a man be what he may, Jew, Seventh-day observer of some other denomination, or those who do not believe in the Christian Sabbath, let the law apply to everyone that there should be no public desecration of the first day of the week, the Christian Sabbath, the day of rest for the nation. They may hold any other day of rest of the week as sacred and observe it, but that day, which is the one day in seven for the nation at large, let that not be publicly desecrated by anyone, by officer in the government, or by private citizen, high or low, rich or poor," close quote. Then someone stated from the audience that, quote, "There is a law in the state of Arkansas enforcing Sunday observance upon the people, and the result has been that many good persons have not only been imprisoned, but have lost their property and even their lives," close quote. To which Mr. McAllister coolly replied, quote, "It is better that a few should suffer than that the whole nation should lose its Sabbath," close quote. This argument is identical with that by which the Pharisees in Christ's day justified themselves in killing him. It was said, quote, "It is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not," John 11, verse 15, close quote. And then says the record Then from that day forth they took counsel together for to put him to death. Verse 53. It is because of these principles unblushingly avowed by the very men who stand in the lead in the effort to secure the enactment of this national Sunday law, and because of the practical effect of such a law in Arkansas and Tennessee, and to some extent in Pennsylvania, it is because of these things that we say to you, gentlemen of the United States Senate, you cannot afford to give to these men the power which they seek in the enactment of this proposed Sunday law. The speech of Senator Crockett's, which I have read, was made in the legislature of Arkansas when he was pleading for the restoration of that exemption clause, when he was pleading for toleration in fact. Senator Blair, do you know whether this young man had money or friends? Mr. Jones, Dr. Lewis can certify whether he had money. Dr. Lewis, the case was never reported to other churches for relief. I do not know as to his personal estate. Senator Blair, do you not think it was a peculiar man who would allow his child to be killed and his wife to starve? Dr. Lewis, the case was not reported to our churches in the North. Mr. Jones, about that peculiarity, I will say that John Bunyan stayed 12 years in Bedford jail when he could have got out by simply saying the word yes and agreeing that he would not preach. Senator Blair, it was a very different thing to be called on to say that he would abstain from the performance of a great duty in his church. He preached the gospel, and he would not agree not to preach the gospel. But here is a man who lets his wife and child die rather than pay $25 or $50 and get out and have an opportunity to go to work for them. Mr. Jones, what kind of law is that which puts a man upon his conscience to choose between his wife and child and paying a fine of $25 or $50? But suppose he had paid the fine and got out and gone to work again. How long could he have worked? When the next Sunday came around, it was his duty to his wife and child to work for their support. Is he to go to work on Sunday and go through the course of prosecution again and again pay a fine of $25 or $50? How long could this be kept up? There are not many poor farmers who can clear from $25 to $50 every week above all expenses to be devoted to paying regular fines for the privilege of following their honest occupation on their own premises. But it will be said, let him not work on Sunday, then he would not have to pay a fine. Well, if he consents to do no work on Sunday, he consents to be robbed of one-sixth of his time, which he honestly owes to the support of his wife and child. For to rob him of one-sixth of his time is precisely what the state does in such a case, and it is either confiscation outright or confiscation under the guise of a fine imposed as punishment for his refusing to allow himself to be robbed of one-sixth of his time. Either this or else he must give up his right to worship God according to the dictates of his own conscience and the Word of God, and so surrender his rights of conscience altogether. It comes to this, therefore, that Sunday laws are a direct invasion of the rights of conscience. More than this, Sunday laws are a direct invasion not only of the constitutional right, but the inalienable right of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property. I here adopt the language of the Supreme Court of California, language which can never be successfully controverted. Quote, the right to protect and possess property is not more clearly protected by the Constitution than the right to acquire. The right to acquire must include the right to use the proper means to attain the end. The right itself would be impotent without the power to use the necessary incidents. If the legislature have the authority to appoint a time of compulsory test, it is without limit and may extend to the prohibition of all occupations at all times. For the Constitution to declare a right inalienable and at the same time leave the legislature unlimited power over it would be a contradiction in terms, an idle provision, proving that a constitution was a mere parchment barrier, insufficient to protect the citizen, delusive and visionary, and the practical result of which would be to destroy, not conserve, the rights which they may assume to protect. The legislature, therefore, cannot prohibit the proper use of the means of acquiring property except the peace and safety of the state require it. Close quote. But does the peace and safety of the state require it in any such case as is here involved? Can it ever be against the peace and safety of the state for any man to follow his honest, legitimate, and even laudable occupations? Is it against the peace and safety of the state to prohibit it? For, as I have before conclusively proved, for the state to do so is for it to put honest occupations in the catalog of crimes, to put peaceable and industrious citizens upon a level with criminals, and to put a premium upon idleness and recklessness. It is certainly against the peace and safety of any state to do any such thing. Therefore, it is demonstrated that Sunday laws are an invasion of the inalienable right of acquiring and possessing property, and for that man in Arkansas to have obeyed that law would have been to surrender his inalienable right. Once more, as the right to acquire property includes the right to use the proper means to attain that end, and as such a law deprives a man of the use of such means during 1/6 of his time, it follows that it is a violation of that provision of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, which declares that, quote, no state shall deprive any citizen of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, close quote. All this, sir, is involved in the question as to whether that man shall recognize the law to such an extent as even to pay the fine. If he does, then it follows inevitably that all his property shall go to pay fines, or else he must choose between yielding his rights of conscience and allowing 1/6 of his time to be confiscated, and in that a certain proportion of property, because to the industrious citizen, time is property. But if the state, by a Sunday law, or by any other means, may confiscate a part, it may confiscate all. Where, then, shall resistance to oppression begin? I say, at the very first appearance of it. Under the cover of the word loan, Charles I undertook to confiscate a small sum of money from each of the property owners of England. John Hampden's share was about $7.75. He was a rich man, but he refused to pay it. And his refusal to pay that paltry sum led to all England's being plunged into confusion and civil war. The king lost his head. Hampden himself lost his life. And all this rather than to pay the insignificant sum of $7.75, less than 1/3 of the fine imposed upon this man for refusing to assent to the confiscation of 1/6 of his property. But John Hampden's refusal to pay that money established the constitutional principle that every man has the inalienable right to acquire, possess, and protect property, a right which was invaded in this case. Upon this principle alone, that man was entirely justified in refusing to pay the fine imposed by Sunday laws. But as there was also involved the inalienable right of conscience, he was doubly justified in refusing to obey the law or to recognize the principle. Senator Blair. Suppose he was a guilty man. Suppose he did not believe it was an offense to steal, and that he conscientiously thought that he could take goods from another in a certain way. He had been convicted under the law and was under the penalty of paying $25 fine. Is he to put his right of conscience against the demands of wife and child and against the judgment of the community and the state in which he lives and to which he owes all the rights to the enjoyment of property and everything else he has? In this case, a man saw all this evil done rather than pay $25 or $50, and he says he did that by reason of his conscience. Mr. Jones, the cases are not parallel at all. Unless indeed you count it as much of a crime for a man to follow his honest occupation as it is for him to steal. This, however, we have demonstrated is the very thing that Sunday laws do. But we forever protest against honesties, industries being put upon a level with thieving. The man who steals takes the property of others without compensation and without regard to the question of right. If, then, the state takes from him property or time without compensation, he cannot complain of injustice. But in the case of the man who works on Sunday, he invades no man's right in any degree. He takes no man's property or his time in any way, much less does he take it without compensation. For the state to punish the thief is just. For the state to punish the industrious citizen is preeminently unjust. But aside from all this, did you ever hear of a man whose conscience taught him that it was right to steal? That it was a conscientious conviction to steal? Senator Blair, I have heard of a great many instances where an individual confessed that he had conscientiously violated the law, yet he was punished. Mr. Jones, precisely. And the Christians were put to death under the Roman Empire for violating the law. Senator Blair, but that does not answer my question, and it is not necessary that it should be answered. Mr. Jones, it is right for any man to violate any law that invades his constitutional rights. And it is his right conscientiously to violate any law that invades the rights of conscience. God declares the man innocent who violates the law that interferes with man's relationship to God, the law that invades the rights of conscience. See cases, the King versus Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and the State versus Daniel, reported in Daniel's chapters 3 and 6. The end of the Arkansas case, as reported by Senator Crockett, was that the poor man lost both his wife and his child. Senator Blair, what became of him? Mr. Jones, he left the state. Senator Blair, I should think he ought to leave it. Mr. Jones, so do I, sir. But what can be said of freedom any more in this country when such things can be? That is also true of six other men who follow the dictates of their own consciences as good, honest, virtuous citizens as lived in Arkansas. Senator Blair, there is a good deal of humbug about the dictates of one's own conscience. If a man is to set up his conscience against the obligations to do what is right and to perform his duty toward society, an unintelligent and uninformed conscience of that kind might be allowed to destroy all society. It is not conscientious always. Mr. Jones, I beg your pardon, sir. The rights of conscience are eternally sacred. There is no conscience in regard to the state, however. Conscience has to do with God and with what he has commanded, and a man reads in the Bible what God commands. I here adopt the words of the present Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, Honorable Stanley Matthews, in his speech in the case of the Cincinnati School Board versus Minor. He says, quote, we may call the eccentricities of conscience vagaries if we please. But in matters of religious concern, we have no right to disregard or despise them, no matter how trivial and absurd we may conceive them to be. In the days of the early Christian martyrs, the Roman lictors and soldiers despised and ridiculed the fanaticism that refused the trifling conformity of a pinch of incense upon the altar, erected to the Caesar, that aggregated to himself the title and honor of divine or a heathen statue. History is filled with the record of bloody sacrifices which holy men who feared God rather than men have not withheld, on account of what seemed to cruel persecutors but trifling observances and concessions. Conscience, if your honors please, is a tender thing, and tenderly to be regarded, and in the same proportion in which a man treasures his own moral integrity, sets up the light of conscience within him as the glory of God shining in him to discover to him the truth, so ought he to regard the conscience of every other man, and apply the cardinal maxim of Christian life and practice. Whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so unto them. Close quote. Senator Blair, should those who conscientiously believe in free love be allowed to indulge in it? Mr. Jones, there's no point in that. Where is there any conscientious conviction in free love? I cannot discover it. There is no room for any. Senator Blair, but there must be laws which prohibit immorality. Mr. Jones, I ask you to define what immorality is, and then I will answer your question. Senator Blair, if you do not know what the expression means, I shall not undertake to enlighten you. Mr. Jones, I know what it means. Senator Blair, then why do you ask me to define it? Why do you not answer the question? Mr. Jones, because there are modified meanings of the word which make it refer to crime. Immorality is itself a violation of the law of God, and civil government has no right to punish any man for a violation of the law of God as such. I do say, therefore, that that which, properly speaking, is immorality, the civil law cannot prohibit, and that it has no right to attempt it. Morality is defined as follows. Quote, morality, the relation of conformity or nonconformity to the true moral standard or rule, the conformity of an act to the divine law, close quote. As morality is the conformity of an act to the divine law, it is plain that morality pertains solely to God, and with that, civil government has nothing to do. Again, moral law is defined as, quote, the will of God as the supreme moral ruler concerning the character and conduct of all responsible beings, the rule of action as obligatory on the conscience or moral nature. The moral law is similarly contained in the Decalogue, written by the finger of God on two tables of stone and delivered to Moses on Mount Sinai, close quote. These definitions are evidently according to Scripture. The Scriptures show that the Ten Commandments are the law of God, that they express the will of God, that they pertain to the conscience and take cognizance of the thoughts and intents of the heart, so that obedience to these commandments is the duty that man owes to God. Says the Scripture, quote, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13. And the Savior says, quote, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, vain fellow in the margin, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Matthew 5, verses 21 and 22. The Apostle John, referring to the same thing, says, quote, "Whosoever hateth his brother is a murderer," 1 John 3. And again the Savior says, quote, "Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, Thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, whosoever looketh upon a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in her heart." Matthew 5, verse 27 and 28. Other illustrations might be given, but these are sufficient to show that obedience to the moral law is morality, that it pertains to the thoughts and intents of the heart, and therefore, in the very nature of the case, lies beyond the reach or control of the civil power. To hate is murder. To covet is idolatry. To think impurely of a woman is adultery. These are all equally immoral and violations of the moral law, but no civil government seeks to punish for them. A man may hate his neighbor all his life. He may covet everything on earth. He may think impurely of every woman that he sees. He may keep it up all his days, but so long as these things are confined to his thought, the civil power cannot touch him. It would be difficult to conceive of a more immoral person than such a man would be, yet the state cannot punish him. It does not attempt to punish him. This demonstrates again that with morality or immorality, the state can have nothing to do. But let us carry this further. Only let the man's hatred lead him, either by word or sign, to attempt an injury to his neighbor, and the state will punish him. Only let his covetousness lead him to lay hands on what is not his own in an attempt to steal, and the state will punish him. Only let his impure thought lead him to attempt violence to any woman, and the state will punish him. Yet bear in mind that even then the state does not punish him for his immorality, but for his uncivility. The immorality lies in the heart and can be measured by God only. The state punishes no man because he is immoral. If he did, it would have to punish as a murderer the man who hates another, and to punish as an idolater the man who covets, and to punish as an adulterer the one who thinks impurely, because according to the true standard of morality, hatred is murder, covetousness is idolatry, and impurity of thought is adultery. Therefore, it is clear that in fact the state punishes no man because he is immoral, but because he is uncivil. It cannot punish immorality, it must punish incivility. This distinction is shown in the very term by which is designated state or national government. It is called civil government. No person but a theocrat ever thinks of calling it moral government. The government of God is the only moral government. God is the only moral governor. The law of God is the only moral law. To God alone pertains the punishment of immorality, which is the transgression of the moral law. Governments of men are civil governments, not moral. The laws of states and nations are civil laws, not moral. To the authorities of civil government pertains the punishment of incivility, that is, the transgression of civil law. It is not theirs to punish immorality. That pertains solely to the author of the moral law and of the moral sense, which is the sole judge of man's moral relation. All this must be manifest to everyone who will think fairly upon the subject, and it is confined by the definition of the word civil, which is this, quote, "Civil, pertaining to a city or a state or to a citizen in his relations to his fellow citizens or to the state," close quote. Thus, it is made clear that we owe to Caesar, civil government, only that which is civil, and that we owe to God that which is moral or religious, and that to no man, to no assembly or organization of men, does there belong any right whatever to punish immorality. Whoever attempts it, it usurps the prerogative of God. The Inquisition is the inevitable logic of any claim of any assembly of men to punish immorality, because to punish immorality, it is necessary in some way to get at the thoughts and the intents of the heart. The papacy, asserting the right to compel men to be moral and to punish them for immorality, had the cruel courage to carry the evil principle to its logical consequence. In carrying out the principle, it was found to be essential to get at the secrets of men's hearts, and it was found that the diligent application of torture would wring from men, in many cases, a full confession of the most secret counsels of their hearts. Hence, the Inquisition was established as the means best adapted to secure the desired end. So long as men grant the proposition that it is within the province of civil government to enforce morality, it is to very little purpose that they condemn the Inquisition, for that tribunal is the only logical result of the proposition. Thus, much on the subject of morality and the state in the true and genuine sense of the word morality. But as I said at the beginning, there is an accommodated sense in which the word morality is used, in which it is made to refer only to men's relations to their fellow man, and with reference to this view of morality, it is sometimes said that the civil power is to enforce morality upon a civil basis. But morality on a civil basis is only civility. And the enforcement of morality upon a civil basis is the enforcement of civility and nothing else. Without the Inquisition, it is impossible for civil government ever to carry its jurisdiction beyond civil things or to enforce anything but civility. But it may be asked, does not the civil power enforce the observance of the commandments of God, which say, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, and thou shalt not bear false witness? Does not the civil power punish the violation of these commandments of God? I answer, the civil power does not enforce these, nor does it punish the violations of them as commandments of God. The state does forbid murder and theft and perjury, and some states forbid adultery, but not as commandments of God. From time immemorial, governments that knew nothing about God have forbidden these things. If the state is to enforce these things as the commandments of God, it will have to take cognizance of the thoughts and intents of the heart, but this is not within the province of any earthly power. By all these evidences, it is established the plain common sense principle that to civil government pertains only that which the term itself implies, that which is civil. The purpose of civil government is civil and not moral. Its function is to preserve order in society, and to cause all its subjects to rest in assured safety by guarding them against all incivility. Morality belongs to God, civility to the state. Morality must be rendered to God, civility to the state. Immorality must be punished, can be punished only by the Lord. Incivility must be punished, and no more than that can possibly be punished by the state. Here then, at the close of my remarks, we are brought to the enunciation of the eternal principle with which I began, upon which we now stand, and upon which we forever expect to stand, the principle embodied in the United States Constitution forbidding religious tests and forbidding Congress to make any law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, the principle established by Jesus Christ. Render, therefore, unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. Remarks by Reverend A. Lewis, Dr. Lewis. Mr. Chairman, the objection raised by Professor Jones against the exemption in favor of Sabbath keepers seems to me wholly imaginary. So far as any Seventh-day Baptists are concerned, I know it would be impossible for any man opening a saloon on Sunday to present the excuse that he was a Seventh-day Baptist. A saloon-keeping Seventh-day Baptist is an unknown thing throughout their history of more than two centuries. Such a man could not obtain recognition, much less church membership, in any Seventh-day Baptist community or church. Nor do I believe, from what I know of Seventh-day Adventists, that such a case could occur in connection with that people. The possibility of any such deceitful claim could easily be guarded against by a provision requiring that in any case of doubt, the one claiming to observe the seventh day should be required to bring official certificate of his relation to a Sabbath-keeping church. Such a provision would end all difficulty. Reply, Mr. Jones. Mr. Chairman, it is certainly true that so far a saloon-keeping Seventh-day Baptist or a Seventh-day Adventist either is an unknown thing, but if Sunday laws are enforced with an exemption clause in favor of those who keep the seventh day, this would not be an unknown thing much longer. It is true also that such a man could not obtain membership in any Seventh-day Baptist or Seventh-day Adventist church. But what is to prevent the saloon keepers from organizing Seventh-day Baptist or Seventh-day Adventist churches of their own and for themselves? What is to prevent them or any class of businessmen from organizing their own churches, electing their own officers, and even ordaining their own pastors and calling themselves Seventh-day Baptist or Seventh-day Adventist? There is nothing to prevent it unless, indeed, the state itself shall take charge of all Seventh-day churches and doctrines and attend to their organization and the admission of members. This is precisely what was done before. In the days of the New England theocracy, Massachusetts enacted a law that, quote, for the time to come, no man shall be admitted to the freedom of this body politic, but such as are members of some of the churches within the limits of the same. Close quote. There were considerable numbers of men who were not members of any of the churches and who could not be because they were not Christians. These men then took to forming themselves into churches of their own. Then the next step for the authorities to take, and they took it, was to enact a law that, quote, for as much as it hath been found by sad experience that much trouble and disturbance hath happened both to the church and civil state by the officers and members of some churches which have been gathered in an undue manner, it is ordered that this court doeth not, nor will hereafter approve of any such companies of men as shall henceforth join in any pretended way of church fellowship without they shall first acquaint the magistrates and elders of the great part of the church's fellowship without their intentions and have their appropriation herein. Close quote, Emancipation of Massachusetts, pages 28 through 30. By this gentleman, you will see that the enactment of this Sunday law, though the first step, will not be by any means the last step, and that in more directions than one. Their offer of an exemption clause is a voluntary confession that the enforcement of the law without one would be unjust. But if that exemption clause be embodied and maintained, the state is inevitably carried beyond its proper jurisdiction, and if the exemption clause is retained and not maintained in its strictness, the whole law is at once nullified. Congress would better learn wisdom from this prospect and utterly refuse to have anything at all to do with the subject. The whole subject is beyond the jurisdiction of the civil power, and the civil power can do no better than to let it entirely alone. But Dr. Lewis proposes to guard against all difficulty by requiring every observer of the seventh day to bring official certificate of his relation to a Sabbath-keeping church. This would not end the difficulty, for as I have shown, it would inevitably devolve upon the state to decide what was a genuine Sabbath-keeping church. But that is not the worst feature in this suggestion. If Dr. Lewis officially represents the Seventh-day Baptist denomination, and for the denomination proposes thus voluntarily to put himself and all his people on ticket of leave, I have no particular objection. That is their own business. Yet it seems to me an extremely generous proposition, if not an extraordinary proceeding. I say they may do this if they choose. But as for me, and for Seventh-day Adventists generally, not only as Christians, but as American citizens, we repudiate with scorn and reject with utter contempt every principle of any such suggestion. As citizens of the United States and as Christians, we utterly and forever refuse to put ourselves upon ticket of leave by any such proposition. Note that my argument at first was not so unfounded nor so wholly imaginary as Dr. Lewis supposed, has been conclusively demonstrated even to himself since this hearing was held. The Pearl of Day's column of the New York Mail and Express, the official organ of the American Sunday Union in March 1889, gave the following statement from the Plainfield, New Jersey Times, quote, "As a rule, Plainfield, New Jersey is a very quiet city on Sunday. Liquor, provision, and cigar stores are closed by the enforcement of a city ordinance. If a resident wants a cigar, he will either have it given to him by one of the many pharmacists who refuse to sell on Sunday, or he will go to the two dealers who are allowed to open their places on Sunday because they observe Saturday as their Sabbath. Some time ago, a man of Catholic faith who had an eye to Sunday business in that line became a regular attendant at the Seventh-day Baptist Church. Eventually, he asked to be admitted into the fellowship of the church. A member of the official board was advised that the applicant for membership was only working for business ends. He was closely examined by the church officers, and he finally admitted that he wanted to open up a cigar store and do business on Sunday. The man appeared at the wrong place for aid in carrying out his mercenary purposes. He was not received into membership," close quote. It looks somewhat like the irony of fate that this thing should fall to the very people whom Dr. Lewis represented and in the very town where Dr. Lewis himself lives. Remarks by Mrs. J.C. Bateham. Mrs. Bateham, I should like to say that the point which has been made was a point carefully considered by the Woman's Christian Temperance Union, and we see the danger, yet we wish to be exceedingly fair. I consulted 9 persons of different classes of Seventh-day people to know whether they wished such an exemption and whether they would be satisfied with what was proposed. They represented themselves as being in approval of some such provision as has been suggested, and we thought it could be done perhaps in such a way as to afford them the exemption which they desire, because they said that such an exemption is necessary. Senator Blair, let me ask you a few questions, Mrs. Bateham, to see if the Woman's Christian Temperance Union understood exactly the relation of what they propose to do in this legislation. Here is a bill which relates to interstate commerce, to postal work, to the Army, and to the Navy. It relates to that subject matter which is carved out of the independent full jurisdiction of a nation by the states, which were once complete sovereignties, and transferred to the general government. The occupations I have mentioned are all of public nature, and to carry them on, the nation has such an opportunity to invade the Sabbath rest laws of every state in such a way as to nullify them. The nation at large is unrestrained by any Sabbath law whatever. If it may carry on its post office business on the Sabbath, it may go to any extent, and it does go already to a very great extent, and an increasingly great extent, so in regard to interstate commerce, and so with the Army and the Navy. Now, you go to our Seventh-day Baptist or Seventh-day Adventist friends, for instance, and propose to introduce a principle by which they can carry on the post office department on the Sabbath just as completely as they see fit. In other words, you propose to exempt them from the operation of the law so far as it prohibits post office work on the Sabbath. Suppose you have a Seventh-day Baptist man for postmaster. Suppose you fill up every post office in the country on the Sabbath with Seventh-day Baptist people. You have the post office department in operation by virtue of this exemption because they can do the work conscientiously on that day. If you limit it by saying the bill shall not apply to the Adventist and others, the bill provides that already. Mrs. Bateham. If you remember the clause, we do not propose to provide that they shall be able to do this work, but that they shall be exempt from the penalty. They are not allowed to do the work, but they are to be exempt from the penalty. Therefore, unless they could prove that they had not done the work to disturbance of others, it would be impossible for them to carry on post office matters, for instance, or any other public employment on Sunday. Senator Blair. Is not that equivalent to saying that if the penalty shall not be enforced against them, there shall be no law against them? Because the law without the penalty is simply an opinion. It is not a law. Mrs. Bateham. The law could provide that they should not open a post office, for instance, or any place of business, and if there was a fine imposed, they would be compelled to close such places on Sunday. It was, of course, only thrown out as a suggestion from us that if it could be done, we should like to have such a provision in the bill. We are satisfied that people want the law, and if the law can, in your wisdom, be arranged with such an exemption, then we wish it. Otherwise, we do not. We are all glad, I think, to have the gentlemen admit that you do not want such an exemption, for that releases us from the place where we were. Senator Blair. This is not to be a general Sunday law. These people all live in the States, and they can work at their private occupations just the same under similar amendments to the state law if the state saw fit to make such amendments. Professor Jones says it did not work well in Arkansas, and I should think it did not from his description. But these are public occupations and quasi-public occupations we are dealing with that are of interstate commerce, for instance, carried on by great corporations which are public in their relation to the working men because they are exercising a great public function in carrying on transportation which appertains to everybody all over the country. This proposed law undertakes to prohibit the nullification of all Sunday rest laws in the states so far as to provide that interstate commerce shall not be carried on in violation of the law upon the Sabbath. When you come to the private occupations, which are regulated by the states, if they choose to allow the Seventh-day Baptist people to work on Sunday in those private occupations on the farm, in the workshop, in the factory, this measure does not interfere with them at all. Mrs. Bateham, I have not the words before me, but my impression is that there is a clause in the bill providing that the jurisdiction of Congress shall be exercised over the territories in this matter. There is something of that kind in the bill, and this proposed exemption was designed to reach those cases rather than apply to the general government action. Senator Blair, you think the exemption might be made with reference to the territories? Mrs. Bateham, yes, that was the point we had in mind in this general action. I have not the words of the bill before me, but there is something of that kind in it which we had in mind. I wish to say also that one of the requests of our National Women's Christian Union was that the word promote should be changed to protect in the title of the bill, so that it should have no appearance of what all Americans object to, any union of church and state. That amendment was proposed and accepted by the American Sabbath Union, the organized body which has just been in session in this city. Senator Blair, do you not think that the word protect implies power to command and compel? An army protects. Mrs. Bateham, all our laws protect us, do they not? Senator Blair, you would make this a law? Mrs. Bateham, I suggest that the bill be made a law, and that it be a law which shall protect the civil Sabbath, not promote religious worship, but protect the day as a day of rest and religious worship. Senator Blair, it seems to me that the word protect is a stronger and more interfering word than promote. However, all these suggestions are important. Reply, Mr. Jones. Mr. Chairman, Mrs. Bateham, in her first address this morning, in telling who they are that are in favor of this Sunday law, said that she believed, quote, the great majority of the people will approve such a law, close quote. She mentioned as opposed to it only the daily newspaper press, the railroad managers, steamboat companies, saloonists, and their backers, a class of foreigners who prefer the Continental Sunday, and the very small sect of Seventh-day Baptists. Honorable G. P. Lord, in his remarks, said that not more than 3 million of our population work on Sabbath, and most of this number are unwilling workers. He said that the balance, or more than 57 million of our population, abstain from toil on the Sabbath. Taking these statements as the truth, it appears that the overwhelming majority of the American people are not only in favor of the Sunday law, but they actually keep that day as a rest day. Now, gentlemen, it is not rather singular and a doctrine altogether new in a government of the people that the majority need to be protected? From whom are they to be protected? From themselves, most assuredly, because by their own representation, they are so vastly in the majority that it would be impossible for them to be oppressed by anybody else. But in a government of the people, when the majority are oppressing themselves, how can laws prevent it when the laws must be made by the majority, that is, by the very ones who are carrying on the oppression? If to them my argument seems unsound, I would cite entirely for their benefit the words of the Supreme Court of Ohio that the, quote, protection guaranteed in our constitutional provisions, quote, means protection to the minority. The majority can protect itself. Constitutions are enacted for the purpose of protecting the weak against the strong, the few against the many, close quote. This is sound sense, as well as sound constitutional law. Now suppose, in accordance with this sound constitutional principle, and under cover of their own statements, we, Seventh-day observers, who they themselves designate as being so entirely in the minority as scarcely to be worthy of recognition, suppose we should come to Congress asking for protection, and as all my argument has shown, if anybody needs protection in this matter, assuredly it is ourselves. Suppose then we come to Congress asking for protection in the same way that they ask for it. Suppose we should ask Congress to enact a law compelling all people to do no work on Saturday in order to protect us in our right to keep Saturday, what would be thought of that? What would these people themselves think of it? What ought anybody to think of it? But that it was a piece of unwarranted assumption of authority to force upon others our ideas of religious observances. That is all it would be, and it would be utterly inexcusable. And I risk nothing in saying that these people themselves, as well as everybody else, were pronounced unwarrantable and inexcusable. But if that would be so in the case of a minority who actually need to be protected, what then ought not to be thought of these people who claim to be in the overwhelming majority in their mission here, asking Congress to compel everybody to rest on Sunday for their protection? Gentlemen, it is not protection, but power that they want. This is the end of part 6.